Welcome to Below the Line, where we talk about working in Hollywood from the crew perspective. My name is Skid. I'm a former assistant director and your host. Today, we're talking about Drugstore June, the indie comedy starring Esther Pavitsky that recently enjoyed a limited run in theaters and is now available to stream on demand. My guest is the cinematographer, Sherry Kalb. Sherry, welcome to Below the Line.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks, Skid.
I'm happy to have you on the show. Quick warning for listeners, today's conversation may contain spoilers, but we're going to try and go light on them because I'm guessing not a lot of you have seen the film yet. Let's start with that. Whatever project we feature here on Below the Line, I always watch it first. Now, Drugstore June is not winning on Rotten Tomatoes, and consequently, I went into this screening with low expectations. But, spoiler alert, this film was a lot of fun. Sherry, tell me how you got involved with this production and what you were thinking when you first read the script.
Absolutely. I know we all do it, right? Throughout our movies, we check on Rotten Tomatoes. And I think even when I first saw the script, it took me a minute to understand what is this film? Gummy bears and a heist movie and kind of a millennial languaging I had no clue about. I did a lot of Googling for some woke vocabulary. Got quite the education myself. But at the end of the day, what I realized is, we take life so seriously sometimes. We want movies to mean so much. And what Drugstore June is about is laughing, is about having fun and about just enjoying time together. So it did make it to movie theaters, which for a $1 million indie feature to screen its premiere at the Grauman's Chinese, to then also premiere in New York City, but not just the two coasts, it's screening inland. I was talking to my sister in Columbus, Ohio this week about trying to get her to the movies. I saw it was screening in a film theater in Columbus, and it's in Las Vegas and Austin, Texas. So it might not change your life like the iPhone or like some films that we saw and see, throughout our years of watching movies, but it'll stop you for a moment and let you laugh out loud and really walk away with a smile. And sometimes that's what a movie needs to be.
Share that point. I think that's the risk of an earlier release where we're all just coming off the Oscars and our minds get in this set of like the best films we've seen the year before and sort of wanting to carry that weight. But then actually going in with low expectations and then just sort of getting into the rhythm of the film, from start to end, it carried me right through. But we're going to go a little deeper on the technical side. Now, talk to me about what you brought to it and then what you did with the script from a cinematographer's point of view.
Every time I approach a project, I bring everything I can. And part of it is realizing what will that be for this particular film. Working with Nick, who's the director, he's a film fanatic. He loves the history of cinema. So he wanted to bring a film and an approach to filmmaking the way the classics did. So working with Panavision was at the top of our kind of gets or our goals. And within Panavision, it was working with Arri. Arri has been cinema since film into digital. When Arri lands a camera, it stays around. And so bringing in that sense a real film appreciation to the process of actually making a movie. We shot it in kind of a John Hughes classic cinema style. We were on dolly. I think we did one scene of handheld. And it became about having a location scout, spending our resources, our indie resources on a location scout and our casting director. And also, even before I came into the project, it was about Nick and Esther taking the time and allowing that ebb and flow of Hollywood to intersect when the time was right to make this particular film. I know that they had been brainstorming it for many years, and then maybe Esther had a career moment, or then Nick might have gotten pulled away. And it's in some way just allowing the film to come up in its own time. And going back to Panavision, when it did finally come up to ready to be made, the dates had shifted a bit, and the E-series anamorphic lenses became available. So again, going back to classic cinema, those lenses have been on hundreds and hundreds of films over the last 50 years that we've all watched. So in this particular film of Drugstore, it became about bringing classic Hollywood to a comedy film.
Is it a matter then of applying the approach to the film, or does this film break down in ways that You're bringing a different intention with the camera to different parts of it.
I think sometimes I can get a little bit too heady about the intention and what does it mean, and what sometimes it's just about finding the right angle with the right talent that just feels alive. There's that balance between visual language and visual rules, and then what is the location telling us, or what is the, how can we manipulate the blocking in a way? But so I think in this film, it was a balance between who's in the scene, where are we, and where's a dynamic angle that actually engages us in that moment to live through the scene with the character.
Let's talk about those fantasy sequences in the middle, where it's very obvious that you're making choices with camera to help push that part of the story forward. There's a gummy bear baby. My brain is still locked on that.
I think it's like 2 feet tall. It's a 2 foot tall gummy bear baby. Yes. I mean, a fantasy sequence can be shot a thousand different ways, as can a car sequence, as can in kind of a intro element to the film. So can a teaser, right? You can approach every element in a thousand different ways. And when I see a 2 foot gummy bear having a birthday party blowing out candles, I pin it. I know it's going to exist. I don't know how. It could exist a million ways. All practical, all VFX. We could do miniatures. There's so many ways we're going to pin it, but I know that's going to be a thing. Same with car sequences. Okay, we have a family in a car talking, four people. How are we going to move around them? We could do it 100 ways. We could green screen, process trailer, hostess trays. We're going to pin that, but we know we need to start building visual approaches to these elements, and in the case of the car, we need to make our budget resources and our time resources balance out the dreams, sort of, in that sense. So, to be honest, when it comes to Drugstore June and the fantasy sequences, we had put our value in the locations. The pharmacy, that was a big decision. That was an expensive place to rent. We talked about it. If we choose this pharmacy location, we're going to have to scale back in different ways or find different ways of shooting other parts of the movie. If we want a process trailer for the family vehicle, for the family scenes, again, is that where we want to put our time? Because it takes a lot of time. And that location to secure the roads in an affordable way was 1.5 hours outside of LA. Like, so the conversations of where do we actually want to put our time and money? And then when we got to the fantasy sequence, the biggest decision we made there was we cannot move to six different locations in one day because we had one day to shoot fantasy. Let's find one location that can house them all and adapt to that location's offerings. And then it really, unfortunately, in this case, because we spent a lot of time and resources on some of these other gets, the fantasy sequence became what can we do with what we have now in 1.5 hours per scene? And we have lights, we have smoke, we have costume, and we have really funny actors. Ready, go. So, as much as we could design it, production design it, and Jen, our production designer, to ask a feat of six locations in one day that have a special look and feel, to ask our grip team to be moving the camera constantly, that is just a Herculean ask for a one-day shoot. And at that point, what I'm doing is looking at the monitor. We're talking about it. Is it funky enough? Is it feel enough? Is it blue enough? Does it look too much like reality? We're making on-the-fly decisions with color temperature, with skewing of the color matrix, with change the light, put the light right behind the person, right behind June, so it flares out. And then we're pretty much in a dead sprint while trying to pick at the details as much as we can. So the fantasy became the fantasy, and then you take it into post, you do all the editing you can have with it, some dissolves, cuts, timing, zooms, and then you put it into color. And colors where when we picked the LUT, which was like a Kodak 5218 representative of film LUT, choosing to go film actually put some visual restrictions on really pushing the look of the fantasy so far, because film, quote unquote, breaks. It overexposes, it breaks down in different visual ways. So we had to then play with that. But so the fantasy came out fun. They had a great soundtrack. We love good soundtracks. And other than that, it was like the classic duck, cool and calm on the top, but you know, frantically kicking below the surface for sure on the fantasy sequences.
I'm very impressed that you filmed all of those in one day. Like, it wouldn't have occurred to me from a planning perspective that it was even possible. And then, but to be able to make those decisions, it suggests a trust of this team and what the vision was of what you were trying to achieve, that everybody could bring their expertise. Otherwise, it just would have, you'd have stumbled on the second scene and that would have been the day.
Be done, right? Yeah, and I want to talk to that. Actually, and the caveat is the fantasy sequence in the diner. Of course, we did shoot that while we had the diner, but then that put that at the end of a really robust day. So how can you squeeze in a fantasy sequence? But what you just said reminded me too, so much of the value choices of this production came in pre-production. I came in late a little bit. The schedules had changed. A DP that I know very well, he could no longer shoot the film. And thank you to Seamus Tierney for recommending me and whoever else, but I was able to come on board. And this production had 3 weeks of paid prep for pre-production for the HOD. So in that 3 week time, I live a little bit outside of LA. I kind of moved into LA a bit so I could stay really close to the director. We had a short amount of time together before we started rolling. We went to many locations and scouted. I went with Jen, again, our production designer. Allison Costuming came on, a costume designer. And production spent that time in prep. And we did hair, makeup, lighting, camera, lens tests at Panavision. So exactly what you said. Once we get to day one, day two, day three, it's no problem being ready for day one. Right? Everybody can get through day one, hopefully, but then the momentum, the train starts rolling, and it becomes just a game of just keeping up at some point. And the challenge is how to stay ahead every single day. And that 3 weeks of prep was a big choice for an indie film to spend that time, almost more time than the actual filming, or almost as much time as the actual filming. It's a big deal.
Yeah, that is atypical. And on a major budget film, 3 weeks is nothing. But with an indie film, that's a huge commitment, as you mentioned. How would you compare that to other films of this size?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think everybody gets to choose their own norm. $1 million is not a lot when you really start breaking it down, and that's not even talking about music royalty rights. So to take 3 weeks, that's a big choice. We would have prepped 3 weeks without paid, but it would have been much more difficult to have the coordination, everybody getting at one location at a time. We have to have somebody arriving there to let us in. We're going to have some production meetings. Like, to be able to pull 20 people in together and in a very official way, you kind of need to make it official. I had that much time on a $6 million film prep, and I've had no time on a $500,000 prep. Again, we all do the prep that we can, but when production can make it quote official and we are all there, blocking that time out, it just makes a huge difference on the day. Even just being able to be in the same spaces early before shooting, it's just a really big value add to any production.
Now, when we're talking about value add, when you were specifically talking about doing the fantasy sequences on the fly and where to place lights and such, it reminded me, looking at your IMDb history, that you came up through lighting into cinematography. And I'm curious how lighting plays a role for you. Again, just having that experience versus one of the other paths.
There's definitely not one path, but if you want to be a cinematographer, knowing lighting is the key to being fast on the turnarounds, to being fast on shooting multiple cameras when you need to, being able to place multiple cameras in one lighting setup, and knowing how to very quickly educate the lighting setup when I'm moving in for coverage. So I think having a lighting upbringing is really about, in some sense, speed and quality, but then also, how many times have I watched or seen it? How many times have I seen a poster of a film, an indie film, looks amazing, and then I rent it or I download it or go to the movies, and when I hit play, I don't know, all of a sudden the first scene is not like the epic poster. Or how many times have I watched a trailer, and the trailers tricked me,
Ha
and again the opening sequence is just not there. So many times it's the lighting, really being able to just replicate both the technical quality of light, but then the feeling of light. It's difficult. It's very difficult. So I think coming up through lighting has given me the respect. It's also launched me in a still very long linear line of just getting better and better and better. But that is definitely where I really come alive and can operate from is setting the lights, calling the lights, knowing if crew have to switch out that I can lean into that or not. But truly on an indie film, or it's not even an indie film, truly on a production schedule, the way we shoot today, the lighting has to be carried with your gaffer and their team because the DP is going through once you're into production and establish the looks. And once the language of light is understood by the gaffer and the DP, and in a sense with the key grip, that's all in the same sphere of creating that quality. There has to be such trust and respect that the lighting helm can just be moving in tandem with the cinematography helm. In this case, I operated on Drugstore June, so suddenly I became the AOP. And if I'm on a film with an AOP, then it's like a in tandem with the AOP, the lighting, the director with me, and we are all moving together. It's not one person calling every single detail. We would never make the first day if we did.
Sherry, I want to also dive a little deeper into something else you mentioned on the side, and that was the decision to use a process trailer for the driving work. And for folks who don't know, it's where the car is actually mounted on a trailer, and so it's not actually driving, that someone else is driving the car, but then you can set lights and cameras and the actors can focus on the scene. But that's a huge investment of time, not just in the equipment, but as you said, going out of town, filming where you can close down the roads. Why was it important for this film to invest in that?
I think, first of all, safety. We have four actors deep in scene work, and I'm not going to ask them to drive. And the director's not going to ask them to drive. And honestly, the actors are going to request or demand not to drive. So at a level there, how are we going to get four cast in a moving vehicle wanting a full performance? We are going to, quote unquote, drive the car. So that's number one. Number two is again time. That was one of the, I think we had four B camera days over the course of Drugstore June. And we had a second camera that evening because four people in a car, front to back. It's just takes time. I remember one of my first features was called Love. It's an Indian feature directed by Sudhanshu Saria, even less than a million. But I've seen this now several times, and I can just smile as I feel several times early directing career choices are, I don't have a lot of money. Let's put them in a convertible and shoot the film. We get location, we get movement, and in theory, it's great and it does work. But shooting in a car, technically, as a cinematographer's requirements, is so difficult. There's just, where do you put the camera? There's so many obstacles, and then sound and lighting, of course. So in this instance, process trailer as one of our big choices, both for safety but also coverage, allowed us to explore the scene, but also in a new and different way than our other car scenes. And this is one though where being an indie film, I'll just tell you real quick, we went out to a university about an hour east of LA, and it was great. They had paved roads. This closed section used to be, it was a built academy and it was a research academy. And so they had buildings and it was all electrified, and the street lights worked, and the buildings we drove by, the lights could turn on, and many, many major shows shoot out there. And the day before we filmed, they had a power outage.
Oh no.
And I thought, what? This is unacceptable. We must get power. And we had no ability to bring in a generator and light a mile and a half strip. And so even on your best attempts, you sometimes just have to roll with it. So our night scenes are definitely night out the window.
We talked about that fantasy sequence and how a lot of the cinematography choices really jump out to make that scene work.
I think something I had a lot of fun with this film, in contrast to some of my recently previous features, is I really wanted to play with color saturation. Sometimes I really just sort of land at a neutral color balance. I love white light. I just love also gradations of white light. But something about Drugstore June, I really wanted to push myself, but also our world into color. And June's bedroom, a lot of fun color there, and really pushing how pink we could get it within the Rec 709 and within the Rec 2020 color spaces without going off our actual technical abilities to replicate it. June's brother's bedroom has a lot of fun color. Allison brought color in the costumes. And also if you go back to her bedroom, Jan, with the set deck, a lot of color pops. And so that just allowed me to have a lot of fun and also have a way of introducing color that doesn't stand out. Obviously, the fantasy is color. We had kind of found on the day that teal blue look. And then bringing all of that in to post, working with Alistair at Photochem, he found this beautiful contrast or back and forth between the blue hues of Drugstore June and the red accents. And there was enough of that back and forth that he really shaped, I feel it's like a really energetic relationship in the frame. So if someone's wearing the red shirt or if the background has red accents in it, or a lot of times June's lipstick is red, that played so well with the way that Alistair then kind of just found that relationship between the blue tones and the red in a funny way. I found this like it really supported the comedy without going overboard. So that was fun for me on this film in general. It's really playing with color.
Talk to me about choices you made that maybe aren't as obvious, but that if I'm paying attention as a viewer, might give me some new depth of understanding in the film.
I think one of the biggest choices, and it's not a choice I made, but it's one that once I recognized it, I could see the whole film. The film is written in three acts, but it's written in a way that each act changes in the script. I think that the film starts during the day, we're with June in the drugstore and her home, and there are a lot of day scenes, and she doesn't really have a mission in life yet. And then the mission is presented. We have a robbery. She's going to go on a mission to find out that. Who did it? So our film turns into a whodunit. And at that moment, when she decides to go on the mission, the second act begins. And the majority of the second act is at night. So we have an immediate visual change. And we also have a kind of a tone change. Now we have a goal. Now we are no longer just sort of meandering through life. We are again on our mission. And then again, when the third act arrives, we've discovered who did it. We are now going to kind of resolve all of our relationships and see what the consequences are of the robbery and things like that. The script again switches back to day. And we return to the drugstore during the day. We return to June's house during the day. So this was a part of the script writing process with Nick and Esther that built in certain cues of style of shooting, but also the look of the film itself. So I thought that was a great way of pushing a script and a story into a visual space from the very first words on the page.
We talk a lot about collaboration here at Below the Line, given the necessity of crews coming together. But you've mentioned it a couple of times, Sherry, and I imagine the pressures with a low budget production, that's even more critical. Was there anything unique about how the team came together on this project, or anything that really struck you about the team building in general?
I think inherent in Drugstore June is everyone at some point, because it's an indie film, rates are not even scale. There's no such thing as scale. Rates are just this is what they have. This is what we have. I think at some point with Drugstore June, everyone that I worked with came to a yes and in a reason why to say yes. And when the people that I worked with on Drugstore arrived with that reason, it just really upped the level. It really upped the level of what people wanted to create inside the frame, what they wanted this experience to be, and what they wanted the movie to be. Because we have a rock star cast. It's incredible, the cast. And when you can't shoot fast enough, you can't be close enough to a cast's home, you can't pay enough. So everyone I feel like had a reason for being there. And that reason allowed us all to just say, okay, we're here now, let's go. And that was a great feeling to just to be surrounded in that energy on set.
Well, I hope we've given our listeners a bunch of reasons to go check out the film if they haven't seen it already. Sherry, on that note, we'll call it a wrap. This was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Listeners, I always appreciate your feedback. You'll find my contact info at our website, belowthelineoneword.biz. That's B-I-Z. You'll also find past episodes and links to all of our social media, so check it out. Sherry, where can we expect to next see your work?
Well, if you did not catch Drugstore in the movie theaters, it is on iTunes and Amazon and all the places where you can rent or buy it. And then coming up after that, because I do work across kind of film structures, so I have a non-scripted TV series coming out on Hulu at the end of the year, which is still a little bit under wraps. So I'll be out there.
Okay, well, Sherry, we'll watch for that as well. My closing credits, thanks to Curtis Five for our music, John Wan for our logo, and to all of our listeners, I appreciate you. Please rate us wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends. Thanks again from Below the Line.
That's cool.